The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, June 9th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, John Huntington, author of Far Right Vanguard, The Radical Roots of Modern Conservatism. Meanwhile, the House has passed a gun control bill banning sales of semi-automatic weapons for those under 21 and banning large-capacity magazines, but the bill is DOA in the Senate. In a ruling yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled to protect many law enforcement officers who work for the federal government from civil rights lawsuits. You heard that right. That means Customs and Border Patrol agents who abuse migrants or anybody, you're good to go. Donald Trump and two of his kids are penciled in to be questioned under oath by the New York AG in July. Two Omicron subvariants, BA4 and BA5, have been spreading in the U.S. and will likely be dominant by the fall, experts say. Trader Joe's workers in Western Massachusetts have filed seeking an election to become the company's first unionized store. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit on behalf of three families of trans kids and an LGBTQ organization, challenging Texas Governor Greg Abbott's directive to investigate parents seeking gender-affirming care for their kids. There are nine families of trans kids currently under investigation in Texas. It's just... And lastly, police have arrested a man allegedly traveling to Brett Kavanaugh's home to kill him. We should probably retrofit his house so there is only one point of entry. I stole that from Matt, who stole that from Twitter.
Yep.
All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Hope everybody is having a lovely Thursday. Before we get into some of the heartbreaking testimony from the children and the parents in Uvalde, I want to highlight this Supreme Court ruling because, as I mentioned in headlines, I mean, it's just, this is like soft fascism, and maybe I'm being generous by saying soft. It allows for a specific large subset of federal agents, essentially really more targeted towards Customs and Border Protection agents, to act with impunity. Stern, Mark Joseph Stern, wrote this up in Slate. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court abolished individuals' ability to sue Customs and Border Protection agents who violate their constitutional rights. In the process, the conservative supermajority came close to smothering lawsuits against all federal officers who defied the Constitution, granting them near impenetrable immunity. So, I mean, there are tens of thousands of Customs and Border Patrol agents, and already migrants, people crossing the border trying to seek asylum. I mean, you've seen the images. They already face insane abuse. But now the Supreme Court is ruling you're not going to have recourse because this is in the interest of national security, essentially. Wednesday's case, Egbert v. Bowl, is the latest and most thorough attack on accountability for federal agents who break the law. The decision arises from a loophole in the federal statute that lets individuals sue law enforcement for damages. This statute authorizes suits against state law enforcement officers who infringe on civil rights, sheriffs, local cops, highway patrol. All can be sued in federal court for constitutional violations. But the statute does not authorize such suits against law enforcement officers who work for the federal government. The Supreme Court addressed this problem in 1971's Bivens v. Six Unknown Named Agents of Federal Bureaus of Narcotics, which involved a claim of excessive force against federal agents. And conservatives have been essentially trying to go after this ruling for a long time. The court has insisted that the precedent applies only when the facts of the case are nearly identical to Bevin's. So in theory, when federal agents use excessive force, they still can be sued. But if that force takes place in some, quote, new context with, quote, special factors, a.k.a. if it's not essentially identical to the precedent, say, some connection to national security, as I mentioned earlier, the suit will fail. And because there is invariably some distinction between two cases, naturally, courts usually had an excuse to toss out Bivens' claims. And so Clarence Thomas basically wrote this up in the Supreme Court and moved the goalposts. He replaced the standard, Stern writes, with an even more stringent one. Judges hearing Bivens' claims, he wrote for the court, should now simply ask whether there is any reason to think that Congress might be better equipped to create a damages remedy. Basically, though, what it comes down to, in this case that was brought, a federal agent allegedly used excessive force against an American citizen on American soil, the precise scenario to which Bevin's ostensibly applies. So it did meet that initial criteria that this is the same thing as the precedent, so you should, in theory, if you were acting in good faith as a Supreme Court justice, which we know they're not, they should be identical. But no, Thomas wrote, because the incident occurred so close to Canada, it was on the Canadian border, it has, quote, implications for national security and border security. As a result, greenlighting Boulay's lawsuit would constitute a, quote, judicial intrusion into Congress's policymaking role. So that's where this opens up this massive can of worms. So tens of thousands of Border Patrol agents, since it was involving the Canadian border in this instance, are going to have the ability to act with even more impunity than they do. We saw images of them using reins as whips, essentially. Hey, if that happens to you, you probably don't have any legal recourse based on the Supreme Court.
This is within a 100-mile border exclusion zone, and if you don't know if you're within that border zone, you might want to look at this map here, which is like if you're near any sort of water or coastline, so, you know, the entire coasts, all major cities on the coasts, are all within this, even like the Great Lakes area, which I didn't know that this, it seems bizarre that like Chicago is considered on the border, but it's on the border, I guess.
Yeah. So just another, go on.
Just to say one more thing. It's like this is, you say fascism, this is making border agents an American Gestapo. And it means that if they find a reason to go into your house for whatever reason that they want, that they'll have a legal precedent that they could cite saying, actually, we're just doing this because of national security.
Exactly. With that said, let's turn to the congressional hearings on Uvalde. This is a clip of Maya Cirillo. She is a survivor of the Uvalde massacre, and she testified to the House Oversight Committee on what happened on that awful day. She thankfully survived, but her friends, her teacher, did not. And she described what happened to her via video call to the House Oversight Committee.
And then she got an email, and then she went to them, and then she went to go lock the door, and he was in the hallway, and they made eye contact, and then she went back in the room and she told us go hide, and then we went to go hide behind my teacher's desk and behind the backpacks, and then he shot the little window, and then he went to the other classroom, and then he went, there's a door between our classrooms, and he went to there and shot my teacher and told my teacher goodnight and shot her in the head. And then he shot some of my classmates and the whiteboard. When I went to the backpacks, he shot my friend that was next to me, and I thought he was going to come back to the room, so I grabbed the blood and put it all on me. And
what did you do then when you put the boat on yourself?
Just stay quiet, and then I got my teacher's phone and called 911.
And what did you tell 911?
I told her that we need help, and she sent the police in our classroom.
If there was something that you want people to know about that day and about you, right? Or things that you want different, what would it be?
To have security.
Do you feel safe at school? Why not?
Because I don't want it to happen again.
And you think it's going to happen again?
So, she...
She's right.
She's right. She describes, if you didn't hear that, smearing blood on her to pretend she was dead. That you might have read that in some of the news reports. Using her teacher's phone to dial 911. She'll be traumatized for life. I mean, I'm just... thank God she's alive, right? But she's going to have to deal with this for her life, as are the families, the parents of the victims. It's not just the 19... who died, or was it 19, and I forget the exact number, at least 19. It's going to be their families who deal with these ramifications. And last night, Biden was on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and Jimmy Kimmel asked him about what he can do, essentially. And Biden said, quote, on gun control executive orders, that he doesn't want to, quote, emulate Trump's abuse of the Constitution.
Insulting.
It's being an institutionalist is not like an actual moral compass. Believing in
it's the opposite.
It's frankly, it's the opposite. But it is it ascribes a artificial moral justification for you to do nothing in the wake of these massacres, and it's not just Uvalde. Buffalo happened, and shootings happened after that as well. It's cowardice that you ascribe some sort of, like, highfalutin justification in order to sleep at night. Obama was saying the same stuff, I remember, in the wake of Sandy Hook, about what cannot be done via executive order because of the Constitution. Maybe, you know, he had some sort of futuristic vision, and he was able to see that he didn't want to, in the past, emulate Trump via executive order, right? That makes sense. It's just, I mean, come on. FDR was unyielding in his use of his executive authority to make people's lives better. That's your responsibility as a leader, not to put institutions first and norms, which is like not really what he's doing. He's just hiding from it.
The Constitution is a slave driver's document, and it shouldn't be respected. Like, I mean, I understand that politicians have to operate within this, but like, you can't over dead kids say that you're going to be paying fealty to the Constitution. It's ridiculous.
Well, also, I think you're right in the sense that this is probably not his intention. But at the end of the day, does the intention really matter when he's basically saying, the mores on Capitol Hill matter more than dead kids?
Yeah.
It's the same end result, regardless of whether he means it or not.
Exactly. That is what you're supposed to do as a politician. You're supposed to make people's lives better. And having affection for and fealty to documents and institutions and norms is giving way too much credibility to, yes, slave drivers, as Matt said, to racists, to a document that was created by wealthy white landowners and skewed towards their perspective. We live in this current reality. And frankly, I don't even think the Constitution says anything about this, but we live in a current context, and your job on this tiny, tiny time you have on Earth, Joe Biden, and this tiny, tiny time that you're in power, is to do everything you can to make people's lives better and not to shrink in cowardice and pretend it's some sort of institutional norm situation. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by John Huntington. We are back, and we are joined now by John Huntington, author of Far Right Vanguard, The Radical Roots of Modern Conservatism. John, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So your book focuses on the far right in its origins and in the United States. And what struck me as interesting and refreshing, frankly, is that you did not start your book in, you know, the Nixon era or the Reagan era, where I feel like a lot of modern retrospectives about the conservative movement, they often fall in that, fall into that. And it's, I think it misses the broader scope of the fundamental extremist foundations of the conservative movement that we're still, frankly, living with to this day. Mm-hmm. Was that a deliberate choice on your part to because you saw that there was maybe a gap in some academia on some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for the kind words. A gap in academia is exactly how I would phrase it. So I do think that there was kind of this tendency amongst academics, and there are people who have written on this since the Trump years about how academics sort of focused on people like William Buckley, Ronald Reagan, the polite faces on the conservative movement who kind of brought conservatism to the broader population. And in doing so, when they focus on those people, they lose a little bit of the anger and the resentment and the racism that helped push conservatism into the political mainstream to begin with. And so I tried to kind of reverse the order, focus on the groundswell happening on the bottom of radicals, conspiracy theorists, you know, white supremacists, and how they were the ones doing the organizing and the, you know, the signature drives, and they were the ones knocking on doors. And as, you know, I call them the vanguard of the movement very purposefully for that reason.
Well, I want to send your book to Joe Biden and have him and Nancy Pelosi and the rest of Democratic leadership, because all we hear is that the Republican Party is not Trump. They're not Trump. There are respectable Republicans out there. And I mean, your book, it just illustrates how that's preposterous. There always were these elements in the Republican Party, even going back to the outset of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And conservatism, you know, as a political ideology, spanned both parties for many years, right? Southern Democrats and the segregationist wing of that party. And so when people like, I guess, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi talk about working with the other side in our very polarized era, they're talking about a form of politics that just doesn't exist anymore. Back in the day, you could have liberals and conservatives being both in both parties, but that just isn't the way things are today. And so things are, the gridlock is much more apparent in our modern era.
So let's start, I guess, at the outset of the 20th century, the beginning there. You know, the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, I think, is a essential part, place of start, basically. Mm-hmm. But also the opposition to the New Deal as well. Talk about where you started your book, and some of the, you know, the confluence of different factions within the conservative movement in opposition to the New Deal, as I say, and also, you know, the rise of far right white militia groups like the renewed Ku Klux Klan.
Absolutely. The early 20th century is very, very important for the rise of conservatism, especially the 1920s, I think, were a really important moment because you have this renewed fundamentalist vigor, you know, fighting against evolution being taught in public schools. You've got the rise of the second Klan and the nativism and racism that brought to the forefront. And that version of the Klan had some 1 to 3 million members, including men of society, politicians. It was not, you know, just a bunch of ex-Confederates in the backwoods. I mean, this was a real legitimate movement. And then when you build into the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt becomes president and starts instituting the New Deal, empowering labor, you know, creating larger government programs, it kind of consolidates a large amount of the conservative, I guess, opposition to the New Deal. You have businessmen who don't want empowered unions. You have Southern segregationists who don't like the fact that, black and brown people are getting government benefits or are getting government jobs, and that might, you know, prevent them from being exploited in ways that they had historically. You have, you know, conspiracy theorists who believe that Franklin Roosevelt is going to bring communism to America. And there was also legitimate fascist movements happening in the 1930s, the German-American boon, the silver shirts. And so all of this together is this broader kind of conservative ecosystem that was trying to fight against New Deal liberalism and the advent of, or the implementation of social democracy in America.
Were they as coordinated as they became later in history, or was this really kind of different factions, you know, which again you could totally extrapolate onto modern day anti-communism, the racists, and the anti-labor part of conservative, or I guess you can put the anti-communist, anti-labor together, but it based on FDR's success and popularity, and again that was the that had to do obviously with factors, you know, the depression as well, but outside of the conservatives' control. But were they not as organized, as you would say, as they became decades later?
That's a really interesting question. And in terms of kind of the themes of conservatism, I will say the song very much remains the same. But I would definitely argue that they do become more consolidated later for a number of different reasons. In the 1930s, the conservative movement that I write about is a little bit more disconnected, right? You had guys like, for example, there was a group called the Jeffersonian Democrats, and their whole goal was what they would view it as redeeming their Democratic Party. They didn't like Roosevelt. They felt like he had perverted their party. And so their main goal was just to get him off the ticket and get a real conservative on there. But Roosevelt was so popular that they struggled to do this. So instead they pivoted to actually supporting the Republican, who himself was kind of like a moderate to even liberal sometimes guy named Alfred Landon. And so as a result, their politics was very much centered on getting rid of Roosevelt. Later on, the conservative movement will coalesce in a way that they will eventually take over the Republican Party, right? And that's where figures like Barry Goldwater and even William Buckley, become important, because they are spearheading a broader conservative coalition than the ones in the 30s and 40s.
So can we talk a bit more about the second coming of the Ku Klux Klan and how that fit into, particularly, you know, what was it, 1915, when they were founded once again, into that time, Birth of a Nation comes out. Mm-hmm. We were chatting about this before the show, and Matt, our producer, was saying that some people call the Klan the first real U.S. fascist organization in the United States. Is that a fair assessment? And perhaps that, you know, you can draw comparisons to the present as well.
So I am not necessarily a scholar of fascism, but I do think that there are notes of fascism, certainly within the Ku Klux Klan, the authoritarian inclinations, the calls to replenish America somehow, the, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but make America great again is very much a, you know, we need to renew, we need a renaissance in this country. And that's what the Klan was offering. And they very much, you know, clung both to the flag and to the cross at the same time, using Christianity and patriotism as a way to otherize certain people, whether it was immigrants or Black Americans or whomever, to create, you know, a whiter nation, or at least a nation in which white people had all the power. And, you know, so I do think that there is an element of fascism in that. You know, a lot of those notes are very similar. And part of the problem with the fascism conversation, which I'm sure if you guys on Twitter are, you know very well, it's been debated very much by academics. Part of the problem is that, you know, many people will only say, well, if it wasn't Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy, then it can't be fascism. But I think that misses the point of political culture, right? A culture of violence, a culture that says that, you know, we need to bring America back to when it was great, usually, which means a wider, more restrictive, less democratic America. You know, these very much are the same sort of appeals that previous fascists have made. And I do think that there is that connection is warranted.
And in conjunction with, say, the first Red Scare movement in around the same period in response to the Russian Revolution, can you explain what that looked like in America around 100 years ago, and how that was fundamental to conservatism at that time?
Absolutely. It's the Russian Revolution happens in 1917, kicking out, you know, the Tsar and really overthrowing the government the provisional government that took over after the Tsar, after the February Revolution. And for Americans, particularly of the conservative variety, they viewed that as, you know, this left-wing movement that was being led by, you know, the Bolsheviks as overthrowing an order that had existed for generations. And so to them, communism in its international kind of revolutionary character became an explicit threat. But communism also became a very useful strategic tool for conservatives. You could just paint any of your opponents as a communist, even if it's not true, and kind of that those accusations had purchased back then. You had a lot of labor strikes going on in that era and in previous eras that sometimes turned violent, and people would say, okay, well, those guys are just communists. And it was a way to turn people against progressive movements. And so anti-communism not only became a widely held belief, but also a strategic tool for conservatives to demonize opponents that they didn't like or that they felt were, you know, taking America in the wrong direction.
How did this, and I want to, you know, we can move a little bit later in history, but I'm fascinated by this time period. How did women's suffrage play into these dynamics as well?
Now, that's an interesting question. And certainly for the Klan, the Klan used white women as as something to be defended. The Klan often would use white women as a symbol, this purity of America. And thus, you know, women in this case were reduced to an object, something delicate and pure that needed to be defended by brave white men. Particularly and often the Klan, of course, would use all sorts of vulgar language insinuating that, you know, black men were trying to take advantage of white women. And so women, for those types of people, it was essential to their politics. Nancy McLean wrote a great book on this called Behind the Mask of Chivalry, talking about how the chivalry of the Klan, they say they're defending white women, but in a way it also kind of masked their violence and the anger that I think undergirded their movement.
Yes. That makes a ton of sense. You mentioned briefly the Jeffersonian Democrats. Could you talk a little bit more about both James Reed, I think he founded the Jeffersonian Democrats, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, and how he led an opposition to FDR using a lot of those prongs that we've previously discussed of mm-hmm. racism, anti-communism as well as the conservative opposition to FDR. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, James Reed is one of those kind of forgotten characters in American political history. He was a Missouri senator, and his big claim to fame as Missouri senator was torpedoing the League of Nations under Woodrow Wilson. Wilson, of course, wanted to form this big international alliance after World War I, and using a lot of racist demagoguery, Reed helped torpedo it, despite the fact that Reed was from Wilson's party, showing that there were conservatives and progressives within the Democratic Party. And then after his Senate years, Reed kind of goes back to Missouri and starts practicing in a private law firm. But then when FDR comes to power, he feels compelled, like he has to, you know, to save the Democratic Party from itself, that they are going down the wrong path. And so in his mind, the key figure that he pulls a lot of his ideas from is Thomas Jefferson. You know, Thomas Jefferson, of course, the writer of the Declaration of Independence, but also a slaveholder and also not exactly a person who wanted everybody to be able to vote, despite the language of all men are created equal. And so when Reed and other Jeffersonian Democrats are talking about kind of redeeming the Democratic Party, what they're talking about is going back in time. This is a reactionary movement, right? A movement saying we've gone too far here and we need to turn back the clock to this previous era, an era that had less democracy, an era where more people knew their place in society. And Reed's movement, the Jeffersonian Democrats, spread into basically every state in the nation. Texas had a very prominent chapter. The guy that ran it was a guy named J. Evetts Haley, who's going to be a figure in kind of a fringe figure, but a figure nonetheless in conservative politics all the way up through the Reagan era. In fact, an interesting note is that Haley, who was a Texas cattleman, he got involved with the Jeffersonian Democrats, wrote a book against Lyndon Johnson in 1964, and then served as a delegate for Ronald Reagan. So literally just like that trajectory of going from radical to mainstream over the course of his lifetime.
That's poetic, right? You could almost trace that and trace your book along with it. How successful were they in, did they get any gains in opposition to FDR and beyond, the Jeffersonian Democrats?
Not really. I often joke that my book is a book of losers. It's a book about losers because many of their elections, they just don't win. You know, these guys put together third party candidates. So, for example, in 1944, there was a group called the Texas Regulars that wanted to get FDR off the ticket. They failed. There was the Dixiecrat Revolt in 1948. They succeeded in some states, but failed largely to get their message out. You know, George Wallace, 1968, loses. And so these guys are all losing. But the important thing is not necessarily the losses, but the fact that at each step of the way, the web is tightening, right? Or the web is growing and the connections are tightening. You know, they're getting to know each other. They're forming organizations. They're getting involved in each other's organizations. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination, and much of it revolves around the activism that they create during these moments, right? In 1956, for example, there was a candidate named T. Coleman Andrews, who hilariously was actually working in Eisenhower's administration as the IRS's main guy, then quits. And then after he leaves government, he turns into an anti-tax advocate and runs in 1956 under a third party banner. He only gets like 100,000 votes. But the important thing is that the third party activism that was going on brings a lot of these guys together. They have conferences in Chicago and they're all meeting and speaking and getting to know one another. And that's where the real important stuff is happening.
So as these connections begin to form, the web of modern conservatism is forming as well. You can also see how these webs of connections give birth to organizations eventually, like the John Birch Society and other conservative infrastructure that's still to this day, they can flex their muscle quite effectively. And would you argue that during maybe the 40s and 50s, that is an essential time period for the formation and consolidation of that kind of organized conservative activism?
Absolutely. I think the 50s are a critical era. I think in my book, I think the title of that chapter is called The Cauldron, because it's this moment where anti-communism now has purchased across all of American society. Even presidents like Truman and Eisenhower are bent on declare themselves anti-communists. Truman implements loyalty programs. And so as a result, this emboldens and it legitimizes a lot of the things that the far right have been saying. You know, they've been saying that the government's been full of communists for 20 years at this point. And now they can say, see, we told you. Mm. Not to mention, you know, Joseph McCarthy and all of his witch hunting and all this stuff. And so absolutely. And what's interesting is that in the modern day, the Birch Society has gotten a lot of attention, rightfully so. They still exist. But what I think is interesting is that the Birch Society to me wasn't the beginning of the far right movement or even the beginning of, you know, the modern conservative movement, but more so kind of a culmination of a moment, because the far right had been building since the New Deal era. And then in 1958, when the Birch Society is created, it's this moment where Robert Welch, the founder, decides, well, the far right has been so disconnected for so long, we need to have a central kind of clearinghouse organization. And that's what the Birch Society became. You know, was this big organization, you know, boasting at least 100,000 members, maybe more. They never released their membership rolls, so we don't really know how many people there were. But the important thing about the Birchers is that not only do they provide kind of a central meeting ground, like a point of convergence, but also they just do things, right? You know, William Buckley isn't out there knocking on doors and getting people to sign signature drives, right? He's writing op-eds in National Review, whereas Birchers are going out there and knocking on doors, asking people to sign signature drives, registering voters. Those are the people who are spearheading this conservative movement. And that's, to me, why the far right is so important.
In their ground game, and in the fact that, as you mentioned, at this point, it's just anti-communism is ubiquitous. And that, would you say that that's an indication of maybe a canary in the coal mine for early rhetorical wins by the conservatives? Because that's a consensus by this time period.
Absolutely. And I think you guys would probably agree that I would argue that conservatives for a long time have been better at messaging than liberals or leftists or Democrats or whomever. You know, they're just so good at winning those rhetorical battles. And I think anti-communism was one of those moments. Now, in fairness, they did get kind of like a leg up, because with the Soviet Union and the post-World War II era making communism kind of this focal point, you know, it really legitimized and kind of fueled the far right's rhetoric. And it, you know, like I said, it made them seem like they were telling the truth, or at the very least that there was something there. And of course, we haven't even really touched on it, but a lot of this anti-communism, though, does lead to conspiracy thinking. You know, that there's this big bad enemy that's kind of pulling all the strings.
Well, John Birch was instrumental in mainstreaming that as well.
Absolutely. Robert Welch, you know, wrote a book throughout the 1950s, and finally he started sending it to people like William Buckley and others. And in his book, it's called The Politician, he basically accuses Eisenhower of being a communist, like the D-Day guy. You know what I mean? Like, he's like, oh, Eisenhower's a communist. And it's just this ridiculous characterization, you know, but he stacks the facts just right to where if you squint at it, you're like, oh, maybe, you know?
Right. And you mentioned Buckley. That's probably important to start talking about his influence, right? I did another interview maybe a year ago. God, all of this blends in my mind, frankly. But Buckley later kind of tried to distance himself from John Birch, but he was, I think, talking out of both sides of his mouth to that degree, because it's another example of this desire, this impulse to say there's a distinction between the crazies mm-hmm. and the Mitt Romneys or whatever. But frankly, it's a symbiotic relationship, and Buckley was very much involved, or at least, you know, kind of working alongside the Birchers and the crazies. What did you in your research find in terms of that relationship? And is my characterization accurate, frankly?
No, I do think your characterization is accurate. And I think this is one of the key areas in which historians have not done a great job of telling the history of the conservative movement, because historians often focused on guys like Buckley. And of course, Buckley wanted to draw those lines of respectability and would say, oh, no, we're not like those guys. And historians picked up on that and then wrote these books about this respectable conservative movement, and that there were these rigid definitions, and that the, you know, the crazies and the kooks were over here and these guys are legitimate. But the problem is that that's not reality. There was a lot of overlap and continues to be a lot of overlap. The conservative movement is a big tent, and all the boundaries that might exist, all the words that we use to describe various types of conservatives, those boundaries are very porous. you know, just to give you an example, in the 1950s, when Robert Welch was writing his book, he corresponded with Berkeley. The guy who, Roger Millikan, one of the key funders of National Review, Buckley's magazine, Roger Millikan was a Birch Society member. Robert Welch donated $2,000 to National Review to help get it off the ground in the early 50s. You know, so the, it's, and in fact, the very views that Buckley had aren't all that dissimilar from the, you know, what the far right was saying. Infamously, in 1957, Buckley wrote a book or wrote an article in National Review talking about race in the South and argued that the white race was, he called white people the advanced race. Those were his exact words, and said that as a result, they have a right to rule. And so it's like, how is that any different from what Southern segregationists are saying?
Right.
It's the exact same thing.
Well, that's a good opportunity to talk about, since we are in this time period, the civil rights era, and how this plays into this. Brown v. Board in the 50s. I'm forgetting exactly what year that was. Or no, 54.
You're in.
54. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. I'm terrible with dates, honestly. This is happening right at the same time period. So just like it was decades before, there's the Klan and the anti-communism elements, mm-hmm. and there's the racism and the continued anti-communism elements. How was this time period of conservatism, it seems obvious, but maybe it's not, you know, developing itself in opposition to black people and to civil rights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the various obvious opposition, right? The people who just don't want segregation to end. And in 1954, you know, there's all sorts of pushback. There's the Southern Manifesto that gets written, I believe, in 1956 by a bunch of congressmen who all sign it and basically say that, you know, the state is, you know, has its boot on our neck, more or less. And of course, then you see guys running for Congress or for president, even George Wallace. But what I find so interesting about this moment is that there are rhetorical shifts that start happening in the 50s and 60s, because at a certain point, in some states, you can still be an overt racist, but in a lot of states, you can't anymore. And so at a certain point, conservatives sort of dial back the racism and shift to what they would call like color, what some scholars would call like dog whistle politics, or even like colorblind conservatism. This idea that they start talking about states' rights and other forms of other things that, if you kind of scratch at that surface, it's still the same old racism. It's still trying to keep Jim Crow around, but not with the blunt racism of the 30s and 40s per se. And again, that's generalizing, but I do think that was happening.
So let's now move to Richard Nixon's run in 1962, because this probably does inform, you know, some of the ahistorical division between the Birchers, the crazies, and the respectable Republicans, because he does try to draw that line himself, not particularly successfully, or make that division. What does his run in 62 say to you about reflect on that time?
Sure. So in 1962, of course, Richard Nixon running for a dog. In 1962, Richard Nixon is running for the California governorship and very much tries to draw a line between himself and the Birchers. The Birchers were very, very powerful and large in California. They had control of or at least very influential, and I believe it was called the California Republican Assembly, the CRA. And basically when he drew that line and said, I am not like those guys, and in fact, we need to distance ourselves from these radicals, they basically made it their life's mission to never let Nixon get elected. And in 62, it works, right? Nixon loses in 1962. And that's where the famous like quote to the media, you know, you don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. And he like huffs off from his press conference. But the point is that Nixon realized something. He had essentially touched the third rail. And the third rail of the conservative movement is the far right. They're the ones who are driving the bus, even if he didn't realize it at the time. And so when he comes back in 1968 and runs for president again, he's much more conservative. He does not make those distinctions as readily. He uses the phrase law and order. Again, that's a great example of that dog whistle politicking. It's not racism, but white people knew what he meant, you know? And so, yeah, absolutely. I think that Nixon learned that lesson in 1962 and then corrected it in 68.
And Goldwater learned. Goldwater kind of learned, and he was more successful in representing both poles of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and Goldwater was absolutely part of the far right. They viewed him as one of their own. And that's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about historians. When they started writing history books about conservatism in the 90s, Goldwater played a huge role as this kind of beginning moment. And to me, Goldwater is not even the beginning, but really the culmination. This was the far right believed that they had made it. In 1964, the Republican Party had its convention in San Francisco, and there were birchers on the ground floor. And when Nelson Rockefeller, the famous New York liberal, got up to speak to the Republican delegates and was trying to say that we need to move away from this extremism, he literally gets drowned out by boos and by chants of "We want Barry." And so the far right believed this was our moment. And then, of course, Goldwater gets absolutely obliterated in that election.
Right.
And so for some people, they're like, okay, well, the far right is maybe too much of a liability. But I think that's the wrong lesson. I think the actual lesson that they took from it is we can't be overtly extreme, but we still need those votes. And so they have to figure out a way to kind of thread that needle. And that's where I think the law and order rhetoric comes from. And these sorts of things, they figure out that way to phrase their politics in such a way that appeals to both mainstream and the far right.
So is that a lesson they take from the shellacking that Johnson gives to Goldwater? Or, I mean, what were some of the lessons learned there?
So in the immediate aftermath of Goldwater, I'm talking like the days afterwards, people all over the newspapers in the country were basically declaring conservatism was dead. That this was, the end of conservatism, that Goldwater had shown that this was a cul-de-sac, right? A political dead end. But William Buckley, in one of his columns, said that he thinks that the grave diggers were premature. He didn't think it was over. And the reason why is because the movement had been built to the point where it could sustain itself. It wasn't just that you could topple over one candidate and that was the end of it. There was still a sustained conservative movement on the ground level being led in part by the far right, and at the top level being, led by periodicals like National Review. And so to Buckley, the lesson was we need to kind of refine our rhetoric and we need to figure out a way to still get our politics across while maybe moderating our language.
Well, and it ended up paying dividends for them later. It is interesting when, talking about Goldwater, I can't help but think about, like, Hillary Clinton embracing, what did she call herself? A Goldwater, Goldwater girl?
Goldwater girls, yeah.
When she was younger.
Right, when she was younger, and she worked for him, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. At the outset of her political career, basically. And, this is a bit, transitioning to the present, but it's amazing how conservatives have been so successful at normalizing their extremism. And until very recently, particularly in the 90s and after, getting like 80% of what they wanted included in Democratic speak and embrace in the form of neoliberalism, frankly, but and also in welfare reform under Clinton. Like, they won so thoroughly the culmination of all of their work and organizing, frankly, paid dividends, not just in terms of like Reagan's landslides and the tax cuts, but the embrace of a lot of the platform in the opposition party.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, and the Democrats, rather than they never quite returned to the liberalism of the mid-20th century. They just figured, well, that's over. We can't do that anymore. That's not where the politics, the general American public is. And so they've shifted to this, the triangulation, the neoliberal era that we still continue to live in. What's interesting, though, is that conservatives are never quite, and I think this is true for any political ideology, but conservatives are never satisfied with the person that they have in power. Reagan's a great example. Reagan cut taxes. Reagan crushed unions. Reagan stripped away regulations. So very much an economic, you know, the libertarian economics, the swaggering foreign policy. But the religious right felt betrayed by Reagan. They didn't think that he did enough for them. And it's fascinating because now the religious right very much feels like Trump is their, you know, that Trump will do what they want him to do. I mean, look at the Supreme Court, right? And so it's, you know, but yet Trump is not, there are still conservatives who believe that Trump is not not doing enough or didn't do enough in his presidency.
Yeah, there's an ideological discipline on the right in terms of the way that the base can flex its muscle that is just absent currently on the left, frankly. I mean, it's getting better, but it's nowhere near the apparatus that has been, as you write. I mean, it's been 100 years in the making, honestly.
Well, I think part of the problem is that the conservative movement has so much more financial heft available. You know, they have billionaires who will just funnel money into think tanks and periodicals, and whereas the left doesn't necessarily have that at their disposal. And it's also hard, especially if you're from a left-wing mindset, to support a party that seems to punch left all the time.
Yeah.
And so as a result, it always feels like the Democrats, the kind of left-wing side of the political spectrum, is so much more fractured. It also has the harder time of trying to be a big tent. You know, nowadays the Democratic coalition is a lot creakier because it's just a bigger tent in many ways, and there's a lot more factions within it. And so it's difficult, you know, what the Democrats are trying to do. But this goes back to the rhetoric, and I agree with you that the right is much, much more disciplined, because even back in the 50s and 60s, they would recognize that, you know, Nixon's not perfect, but he's better than that guy. And so they would vote for him and then use that as a stepping stool up to the next big victory. And the left just doesn't have that. And there's a lot of different reasons why, but that's just, I think that is true.
Well, I mean, I could rant about the Democratic Party until I keeled over. But I mean, I do want to just emphasize how your book just makes it so clear that the battles that we're seeing, or not even the battles, but the factions within the current conservative movement, it's really nothing new. Marjorie Taylor Greene versus Mitt Romney. I mean, that is the same big tent that you describe. And so to bring it back to where we really started our conversation, it's super clear to me that they might be different shades within the same enemy. I mean, I perceive the right as an enemy. Mm-hmm. But they are one and the same. And so I think that's fundamental to understanding the enemy, is not to say, oh, that we want to go back to the good old days when there were respectable Republicans, like Goldwater or like William F. Buckley, who all were this. It's just the same thing. It's just we don't have the historical literacy to understand that in this country, frankly.
I think what Pelosi and others are fail to realize is that the difference between the radical conservatives and the mainstream conservatives, it's a difference of degree, but not kind, right? They're part of the same movement, but many times they're advocating for the same things, maybe just using different language.
Exactly. All right. Well, can't thank you enough. John Huntington, you can check out his book, Far Right Vanguard, The Radical Roots of Modern Conservatism. John, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate the discussion.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Of course. All right, folks, with that, we are going to head into the fun half. Going to be taking your calls, reading your IMs. Binder and Brandon will join us. But
at
Matt,
some point, I think.
Yes, but Matt, what happened on Left Reckoning last night?
Yeah, we had Kurt Hackbarth on yesterday evening to talk about AMLO not appearing at the Summit of American States righteously, and the retaliation. We updated. Basically, Ilhan Omar signed a letter saying that AMLO doesn't care about journalists dying. That was really, in my opinion, and the opinion of Kurt Hackbarth, our guest, something that Congress put together to discipline AMLO for not appearing at the Joe Biden, Jair Bolsonaro, Summit of American Democracy, or whatever they're calling it. And it was bad of Ilhan to do. So we talked about that last night. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We also talk about trailer park oligarchs who own too many, and then alternative models of ownership there, and the Fed coming to suppress wages. And also, we had our first summer stream where we, the post game wasn't just for members. We streamed it on Twitch last night, and Ben Burgess joined us for that. So you can get that for free, actually. The post game is free on Twitch right now. You can go watch the replay. Twitch.tv/LeftReckoning. Go subscribe if you subscribe on Twitch.
All right, we'll head into the fun half before they join us, but definitely check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy, and check out The Discourse. Those are great shows from our friends, Brandon and Matt Binder. We'll be getting into it. Maybe we'll be talking a bit more about that drag show for kids controversy with Binder and more. We'll be taking your calls and reading your IMs, 646-257 39. Wait, I tried to do that by memory and then I second guessed myself.
6-2-5-7-39-20.
Yep. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
If it's me, hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
We are back. We are back in the fun half of the program, and we are joined by our friends Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton. What's up, guys?
Friends, I'm, you know, so glad to hear that. I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Did you not feel the same way?
Oh, no. I just thought we were, you know, like work colleagues. I didn't want to presume.
Well, I think we can now be friends.
Thank you.
Okay.
How are you two doing, friends?
I'm doing good. Glad to know that we're all friends. That's the main takeaway, I guess, right now, right?
I think it's a good thing. It's a real big step for us.
Yeah, you know, in a world full of antagonism amongst the left, I think that, you know, the three of us, five of us, if you include Matt and Bradley being friends, is a positive step forward. Oh, okay. Well, you know, there has to be some delineation. Otherwise, you know, everyone can't be your friend, but they're my friends. So I'm going to be a big tent friend kind of guy, and you can be
more selective.
No, I'm just
joking. All right. Well, what's happening over on Doomed and Scam Economy and the discourse, guys?
Sure. So on Doom this past Tuesday, it was a Matt Binder solo episode. I basically walked everyone through a recent piece of reporting from me about how, you know, trolls basically fabricated fake screenshots to try to tie the Buffalo and Uvalde shootings together and spread more nefarious conspiracy theories, somehow more nefarious than what actually happened, where, you know, dozens of people in each, you know, all together were killed. But yeah, so I went through that on Doomed, which you could check out at youtube.com/Matt Binder and doomedcast.com for the podcast version. And then tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time on Scam Economy, I talked to Leo Schwartz. He's a journalist with Rest of World. And he had a few great pieces we talked about. But the overarching theme of the episode is basically trying to understand exactly how bad the recent crypto crash, where, you know, Terra and Luna failed, taking the crypto market down with it, how badly it affected just everyday normal people, especially outside the U.S. in countries like Argentina and Iran and Nigeria, where unfortunately very vulnerable people put their money in this stable coin. Simply not even as like a long-term investment. We're not talking tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking like $1,000 just to like save their money from the inflation in their country based on their own country's currency. And they've now lost everything. So very interesting episode. Be sure to check it out live tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time, youtube.com/Matt Binder. And the podcast version of the show will be up at scameconomy.com and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Amazing. All right, what's happening over on the discourse, Brandon?
Well, my co-hosts have mercifully agreed to come off of strike and meet with me this weekend to discuss many topics. So lucky for our fans, there'll be a new episode out by Monday. Or, you know, heads will roll. Not mine, but someone's. Not my co-host either, but someone.
Gotcha. All right, well.
That's the kind of accountability I can promise.
You rule with an iron fist, it seems like.
You know what they say, iron fist, warm heart.
Everyone says that, you're right.